history, you know, of the plant pathology department that is recorded through...
On a tape recording?
Through 1960.
Oh, that's interesting.
We did a... We had a meeting of our National Society in Green Lake and had a slideshow, which we did not tape. Then we repeated it. This was in 1958. Then we repeated it in 1960 when we moved into Russell Laboratories. And then we recorded it. And it's really quite good.
What have you done with it?
Well, we've used it. And we're going to celebrate the 75th anniversary of our department next year. Oh. It will be used again.
Yeah, so it's several different people talking on the tape.
There, right? Yeah, what we did, we wrote this history, and then there are four of us who speak various parts as we recount the history of the department.
Who were the others?
Let's see. Bob Patton. Jim Kuntz and Don Hagedorn. And Kuntz is retiring the end of this month. And Patton and Hagedorn still have a way to go.
So you were trying to go way...
We went back to the beginning.
People. You did.
Yeah, what we did, we came over to the archives and we dug out early things about the department. I would think that our department probably has as complete, if not a more complete, picture of everybody who has ever gotten a degree in our department, including all the old staff. And we have that on Rogues Gallery in the department, on the second floor of Russell Laboratories.
And do you have a copy? So something is written out, is that right?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure.
Have you got a copy of it?
Sure. Got lots of copies.
Nice. Is it in the archives? Have you?
No, it's not in the archives.
A copy in the archives? Because people...
Well, yeah, except that without the slides, it doesn't mean much. Because we refer to what we're looking at.
Yeah.
You see.
Well, it's nice to know it exists.
Yeah, yeah.
We've recorded it here. All right, well, I will just make my usual statement that this is an interview with J. Duane Moore. Is that the right way to say it?
That's right.
on the 12th of December, 1984, we're doing the interview in the Oral History Office in the Red Gym. I'm Laura Smale, and this interview is for the University Archives Oral History Project. And this is an interview about your research. It's not about department history, and I'm glad that's been done elsewhere.
Well, when I was a kid, we moved across the street from a florist in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And as I remember, I was 10 years old when I was given a job pulling weeds. And I found I was interested in plants at this point. And so all the way through high school, I worked for the florist. And I graduated from high school during the Depression. So I was not I graduated in mid-1932 and was not able to go to college until 1935. And enrolled as a botany student at Penn State University. I fully intended in getting a degree in botany and then going back and becoming a florist someplace. But in the botany department, I met Henry Thurston, who was a plant pathologist working on tree fruits in Pennsylvania. He offered me a job to work at the fruit research station in Aaronsville, Pennsylvania during the summertime. And this got me interested in working with tree fruits. As I was approaching the time to graduate from Penn State, Henry said, "Why don't you go on and do graduate work?" And I said, "Well, what about it?" And he said, "Well, why don't you apply to Wisconsin and Cornell? They're the best graduate schools in the country at this time in plant pathology. So I did, and I had an offer to come to Wisconsin, which I accepted. I came here as
on
a Wharf fellowship and worked with George W. Kitt as my major professor. He had come here as a graduate student himself back in about 1910 and was head of the department or chairman of the Department of Plant Pathology at the time I came here and the leader of the fruit section in the department. I remember that he was working on a number of projects, working on the genetics of the fungus that incites apple scab. He was working with cherry leaf spot fungus. He had just started a project on a disease of cherries which in the past had been thought to be a physiologic disease. But he had recently shown that it was incited by a virus. So I was given an opportunity to choose a thesis project. And since I had worked as a florist, knew how to grow perennial plants, and perennial plants in a greenhouse, I suggested that I do a virus project on cherries. And he was a little skeptical at the time that we could grow cherry trees in the greenhouse, but he gave me the opportunity to do it, and we very quickly showed him that we could. At the time that I got in the project, a lot of survey work had been done in the orchards in Door County to show that new trees were showing these yellow symptoms each year. Additional trees. At the same time, another set of symptoms that looked something like insect damage had been observed in these surveys. But these trees that showed this type of symptom never showed the same type of symptom in subsequent years. But when we brought the program into the greenhouse and were fortunate enough to get nursery trees that did not have virus infection, we were able to show that the insect feeding type of symptom was also incited by virus. And this led not only to a thesis project for me, but to a whole lifetime work on virus diseases in tree fruits. The program, of course, was of great interest to the nurserymen because they were being accused of producing trees that were infected. And I remember we had numerous meetings with nursery associations in Chicago and elsewhere. And so this led to quite a program. In 1948, when Congress passed a Research and Marketing Act, that involved regional research on various things, a project was proposed for the North Central region to work on stone fruit virus diseases. And I got involved in that very early. By 1954, all of the regions of the United States were equally interested in virus diseases of stone fruits. So at that time, an interregional project was formed, and I became involved in that from the very beginning. This project has its home base out in Prosser, Washington, and eventually we developed a virus-free repository in the Moxie Desert in Washington. I served on that committee from the time it was started until the time I retired. And I am now emeritus chairman of the department, of the committee working on this problem. So that I would say that through the years, we've been very much interested in the virus diseases, tree fruits. And in the later years of my research, I also became involved in the virus diseases of apples, pears, and that sort of thing, of the pome fruits. Now, at the same time that all the virus work was going on, we, of course, were trying to service the fruit growers of Wisconsin with respect to fungus and bacterial diseases of trees, tree fruits. So we had active programs on apple scab control, cherry leaf spot control, brown rot control, fire blight of apples, pears, and that sort of thing through the years.
Did you yourself make some particular discovery about the, one of these diseases that you could talk about more or less from the beginning when you decided to work on it and how you went about it?
Well, I would guess that maybe the most interesting thing about it, at the time we began working with tree fruits and viruses of tree fruits, the thought was that viruses that infected woody plants had no relationship to viruses that would infect herbaceous plants. And we were able to show that we could mechanically transmit viruses from trees to plants like cucumbers, tobacco, and this sort of thing. And this, in a way, I guess, opened up a whole range of research projects, not only in this country, but throughout the world, where people felt that indeed you can transmit viruses mechanically from trees to herbaceous plants.
So this was something that you yourself determined?
Yes.
How did you do it?
Well, we were always looking for ways to transmit, because in the first place, the two major virus diseases of, say, sour cherries in Wisconsin are very difficult to detect in nurseries. The important disease that reduces the yields of trees must have night temperatures, beginning about petal fall, below 60 degrees Fahrenheit for the diagnostic yellow leaves to show up. And most of the nurseries that produce nursery stock that we would be using are in regions where these night temperatures wouldn't occur. So this meant that we had to find a way to index, to find out whether a virus was present, even though you couldn't see diagnostic symptoms. Mm-hmm. Likewise, the disease that I referred to that gave symptoms like insect feeding, this virus becomes latent after a year in the tree. In other words, if a tree shows symptoms 1 year, it probably will never show symptoms again, but the virus is present.
How did you discover that?
Well, by being lucky enough, as I said earlier, to have used nursery trees that were virus-free, so that when I made grafts from the trees that had the Yellow's disease to these nursery trees, mm-hmm. I incited the type of symptom that we had seen in the field and didn't know what it meant. So that was, in itself, a sort of a lucky break.
And what made you think of doing that?
Well, we were interested in transmissions. It had been shown, not too conclusively in the field, that the Yellow's disease, the disease that makes yellow leaves, incites yellow leaves, was transmissible. But we really wanted to pin it down and be able to do it in the greenhouse. And at the time that we were doing it then, after we inoculated trees, we put them through a temperature regime. We have in the plant pathology department greenhouses that the temperatures are controlled at 16, 20, 24, and 28 degrees centigrade, mm-hmm. day and night. And the only place we got yellow symptoms was at 16.
Oh. You had to have samples in each of the...
Yeah. What we were trying to find out, of course, is why this disease was evident in places like New York, Michigan, Wisconsin, rarely in Pennsylvania, practically never in any of the southern states, like, well, not real south, but say Indiana, Illinois, places like this where nurseries are located, Iowa. And we wanted to understand the geographic distribution of the disease and what the environmental factors were. That was the reason it was brought into the greenhouse.
We hadn't noticed that it was showing up and thought about that it was showing up in the northern states.
That's right. And we thought temperature might have an effect, and so it's a real simple thing to check it out, see if it does.
So this is a, you think of as your major contribution, is that?
Certainly in the area of the viruses. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, serving on the committee all the years and helping develop policy for the nursery industry as to how to proceed to produce virus-free material that would be then sold to growers, yeah, to farmers.
So that was a problem that you tackled also?
Yeah, well, we were intimately involved in it along with other people.
Who were you?
Well, Kit was involved in the early years, mm-hmm, because he had been the leader of the project. Of course, he retired back in the 50s, mm-hmm, and I took it over completely at that time. And then I'm referring...
You mean you and your graduate students?
Well, I and my graduate students, plus all the other people who have served on these regional and interregional committees that had to do with producing virus-free nursery stock. Mm-hmm. And then out of that, we published a handbook. There's actually a hand... Well, there are two handbooks, two USDA handbooks, mm-hmm, on virus diseases of stone fruits. And the first one was published, I don't remember exactly, but back in the, probably in the 50s, early 50s, maybe late 40s. And then the one that was published, the most recent one that was published in 76, I served on the editorial and publication committee for that handbook.
And the first one you wrote,
it was written by various people who were working on specific diseases, and I helped write part of it. Mm-hmm.
Did you spoke of genetics? Were you doing anything with genetics?
No, this was a project that Kit was involved in at the time, and he, I guess to be perfectly fair, he tried to talk me into doing a, mm-hmm, thesis problem on the genetics of this fungus. I wasn't interested, but he I'm just not as interested in that sort of thing as I am in growing plants. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me the opportunity to do what I wanted to do. And it turned out fine.
This disease is in the trees but doesn't produce symptoms, but is it hurting them?
Well, the Yellow's disease is reducing crops by about 50%. After the tree is infected for 3 years or longer. The ring spot disease, which gave the symptoms like insect feeding,
yeah,
reduces the crop by about 15%. And so they are of quite some importance to a grower, because the important thing is that neither one kills trees.
Yeah.
And so trees just stand there with reduced yields. And they take the same amount of spray, the same amount of fertilizer, the same amount of all kinds of care,
yeah,
but don't pay their way. As a matter of fact, before we knew the cause of the disease, people in New York State started calling them border trees, B-O-A-R-D-E-R, because they weren't paying their way. So it was an interesting problem to work with.
And why had you picked on these particular diseases?
Well,
you said there was a survey in Door County.
Well, because it was very early in the study.
Yeah.
The indications were a virus was involved.
Yeah.
There were many ramifications which weren't understood. And I like to work in the greenhouse as well as work with plants, and so it just seemed natural that I would do this.
Do you have to use microscopes?
No.
The
No. Well, in later years, people have been able to use the electron microscope to see the virus particles. Mm-hmm. But I did not get intimately involved in that phase of it. Other people
had. Because you knew they were there and you knew what they were doing. And you.
Sure. And other people have worked with it.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Fulton, who has just retired from our department, came into the program. And he's done a lot of work with the viruses.
Mm-hmm.
Not with the diseases, but with the viruses themselves.
You said Kit,
G.W. Kit.
You said that Kit. He was doubtful that cherry trees could be grown in greenhouses.
Well, remember now that this was quite a long time ago, and most of the people in our department were not working with trees. They were working with potatoes or cabbage or tobacco or something of this sort. And there's a trick about giving trees enough cold treatment so that you can bring them in the wintertime and make them grow like they would in the spring.
Cold treatment, you mean outside?
Yes. Sure, in order for any of these trees to grow, they have to have an amount of temperature below 40 degrees and to make them grow. Otherwise, they won't grow. They have to have cold. And I merely adapted to this thing what we had been doing with azaleas and rhododendrons and things like this when I worked as a florist. So I just made cherry trees.
Did you know it was going to work?
Sure, I knew it was going to work.
But I should think that somebody else would have known too then.
Well, later on, other people. Kit had actually been doing some work with apples. But, and so I'm not quite sure why he thought that we couldn't make cherries do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they had tried to grow a few cherry trees and hadn't been successful. But they really hadn't worked at cherries as hard as they had at apples, I guess.
Could you get plenty of greenhouse space?
Yes. In those days, we had quite a lot of experimental greenhouse space. As a matter of fact, part of what I did in the early years, I did in rented greenhouse space at Penny's Nursery in Sturgeon Bay.
Oh.
Since we didn't have enough space down here to do everything I wanted to do, Penny's had bought some greenhouses at Green Lake and had moved them up there and put them up, and they weren't geared up yet to use all the greenhouse they had bought, so they rented me space.
Hmm.
And we did it up there.
And you could control the temperatures.
Oh, sure.
The way you needed to.
Yeah. In the wintertime, it's not too hard to control temperatures in the greenhouse.
And how long would it take you to grow a cherry? It must have been several years before you could.
Well, we started out in the beginning by buying trees from nurseries. But we very quickly learned that many of the trees that we would be buying from nurseries were already infected. And so they weren't usable. So we began propagating our own trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we propagated thousands of trees in this time.
That were virus-free.
Sure. Sure. We had virus-free material that we would use to collect budwood to propagate our own trees on seedling rootstock.
Did you have to worry about there being a the tree that would spread the virus, or you're spreading it on yourselves by yourself?
Well, most of what we did was done by inoculating, either with grafts or with budding.
Mm.
And in the greenhouse, we had no fear whatsoever there could be natural spread.
Mm.
So no, this was not a problem.
I suppose you had no trouble convincing farmer. Orchard people when you found a way of spreading.
Well, we didn't have any trouble convincing them that they ought to use virus-free trees, but we still don't know how to keep trees virus-free when we plant them in the field. We know there's a natural spread,
mm-hmm.
but we don't, to this day, know the whole story. There's some evidence that the bulk of spread, the major spread, is through pollen. From tree to tree, from infected trees to healthy trees.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think the whole story is written on that one either.
Like, why hasn't that been solved yet?
Well, it's just not that easy to solve. People have looked for insect vectors, as has been the story with many viruses. But it's just not that easy to solve. Many people have worked on it. And while there's some evidence, I think there's evidence that there must be other means of spread as well. Well, obviously, in the early years, the main problem was that we were buying infected trees. Before nurseries knew anything about what was going on, they were propagating infected trees. Growers were buying infected trees. They were planting them. They never did amount to anything because they were infected when they were bought.
So when you said you were lucky enough to get some that weren't infected.
That's right.
How did that happen?
Well, we knew a nursery in Indiana and another nursery in Iowa that had a pretty good reputation. And we just bought a few trees and tried them. It wasn't anything smart on our part. We were just lucky that, you know, we were able to get healthy trees to start with.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're very fortunate. The other area of research, if you want to get into it at all, again, when I first came here, Kit was developing a program of trying to control apple scab by a means that nobody had ever tried before. The apple scab fungus lives over the winter in the dead leaves on the ground. And in the early spring, during rain periods, spores that are produced in the dead leaves are discharged into the air. And if they fall on susceptible apple tissue, they start the disease cycle all over again. Well, when I came here, Kit was very much interested to see if we could spray the ground, spray the dead leaves on the ground. And he had tried, a number of different things with some success. And about that time, a new herbicide had come on the market for controlling broadleaf weeds in grain. And Kit said, let's try it on the ground. So we tried it on the ground. It worked. And we developed a spray boom then. We put it on by hand in the beginning with spray guns, just spraying the ground. Uh-huh. And we developed a spray boom. And this practice was then used for quite a long time in those areas of the country where scab is a serious disease. But when new fungicides came on the market that gave better control than the old fungicides had, then it was no longer economically practical. But even today, when there's a very bad scab infestation of the dead from the dead leaves on the ground cause a lot of infection, we still have some people who go and spray the dead leaves on the ground. And that was kind of a fun project to work with too.
Because it worked.
Because it worked.
This is side two. Did everything go completely smoothly with these various projects?
Well, that would be expecting too much, I'm afraid. No, there were reasons for people to doubt. The nurseries, of course, back in the days that we began talking about viruses in tree fruits, they were rather reluctant to embark on a program of producing trees. It would be expensive. But
you mean producing
virus-free trees. But when we were able to show them that one of the reasons that they were getting such poor bud take in the field when they were propagating was because of infection. Mm-hmm. And then they began to sit up and take notice because it really meant a lot to them to get 100% bud take or very close to it.
Yeah.
When with some of the viruses, they were getting very, very poor production of trees.
And that's what you were getting, nearly 100%.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Over how many years did you have to grow these cherries and make these tests to be sure that this was working and you were getting good production?
Well, of course, this program was taken. I mean, what we became interested in was not only what are the viruses in sour cherries, which are the important crop in this state, but are these viruses present in peaches, in plums, in apricots, in almonds, and all this sort of thing? And how do these relate to diseases of those species that other people are working on in California, Pennsylvania,
yeah,
wherever, Florida? And so this then evolved into quite a program of looking for host ranges of the viruses.
How'd you do that?
By merely getting these different species and inoculating them with known viruses that we had. So we could take buds from, say, a sour cherry tree and inoculate a peach, or inoculate a plum, or whatever.
But you had to grow those trees yourself first.
Well, again, we started out by buying these from nurseries. And then if we got into a period where we weren't satisfied that what we were getting was good scientific material to work with, we began propagating our own trees. And by the same process we had used on sour cherries.
You must be talking about several years for one tree.
Well, you see, for example, if I inoculate a sour cherry tree at bud break, when the tree is beginning to grow in the spring in the greenhouse, if I inoculate it with the ring spot virus, I can expect to get symptoms in about 2 weeks. I can't expect to get yellow symptoms until the next year. And if I put one of these viruses into a prune tree, like an Italian prune tree, I'm not certain of a negative reading in less than 3 years.
Oh, yes.
Because it may take 3 years to get symptoms. So it depends on what, you know, what you're working
with. And you have to be sure the tree's healthy first.
That's right.
But you can test for that.
Well, what you could do, you see, if you bought, let's say, an Italian prune tree, and you wanted to know whether that Italian prune tree was healthy when you started, you would inoculate a sour cherry tree with buds from that tree.
Oh, I see.
And if you didn't get a symptom on a sour cherry tree within this 10-day period, then you knew that the plum tree was all right to use, and you could go ahead and inoculate it.
At first you had to be sure the sour cherry tree was all right.
Well, of course, we had propagated these, and we knew these were free. When we got into the period of growing our own trees that we were using, then we were quite certain that what we were using was virus-free. So it was fun. It's something like being a detective, you know.
And how did you reach the nurseries to persuade them? What was the process by which they became convinced that you were right?
Primarily, the Illinois Nursery Association has a national annual meeting in Chicago. And I'm told that more nurserymen go to that meeting than go to their ordinary national meeting. And so Kit and I would be on the program to go down and give presentations, slides, talks, whatever, telling them what we were learning and reaching them that way. And so once they were convinced that it meant something to them to be able to produce virus-free trees, they were all very cooperative. They would offer trees and backing, everything else.
Did you have to give talks for several years before they became persuaded?
Oh, I would guess we maybe went to that meeting in Chicago 3 years. But I've gone to growers' meetings in New York, Ohio, various places also to tell about our research.
Did they listen to you when they asked questions afterwards?
Oh, you bet. Very interesting. Yeah, if it means an increase in production, it's pretty important.
Were any of the things, so what you were doing, you weren't dealing with any kind of substances that were going to be harmful in some other way, the way pesticides and wood for the farmers and crops. Is that right?
Yes, I think so, although I was amused one time because the extension plant pathologist in New York State came out with a story right after we had shown that you could transmit the cucumber, warning the cucumber growers in New York State that they had to be careful that the viruses from cherry trees didn't infect their cucumbers. Well, there never was anything to that. There's never been any evidence for that whatsoever. This was all experimental that we had done. The other side of the thing, which was quite interesting, one of my very good friends in Oregon who worked with some of the same materials I worked with died a rather mysterious death. And people were convinced, since there was some effect on his brain that nobody had ever seen before, that he had infected himself with one of these tree viruses, because the inoculations that he was making to cucumbers and other herbaceous plants, we had always done it with a little piece of cheesecloth with carborundum. He was merely putting carborundum on the plants and then rubbing them with his finger. And so people thought that maybe that's what happened, but many of the folks who were working transmitting these viruses mechanically were tested. No evidence whatsoever that we were infected.
You must have worried for a while.
Well, I never did, because I never thought that there was anything to it.
Oh.
But there was quite a to-do about it. It was checked at the National Institutes of Health in Atlanta. Mm. But nothing positive ever came out of it. Huh. So as far as we know, viruses that infect plants don't infect human beings.
Does your work with viruses interact at all with vegetable growers? Do you have things to say to each other, or do you?
No, because we have other people in our department who work on virus diseases of vegetable products.
But I mean, do you talk with them? Do you learn things from each other about viruses?
Oh, sure, you would. I mean, a lot of the things that people do, they might use similar techniques. In other words, the techniques that we use to infect cucumbers with viruses from trees were very similar to the mechanical inoculation techniques that people use in working with vegetable crops.
Mm-hmm. So there was give and take. Read each other's papers.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And what happened to Door County? Are their crops good now because of this research?
I don't really think that, well, let me say it this way. The cherry acreage in Door County is way down compared with what it was, say, 30 years ago. This doesn't have much to do with the effect of virus, I don't think. We're planting better trees now than we were then. We're planting virus-free trees. But the reason the acreage is down was economic reasons, because it was a period in time, and we're coming to that again, that it costs more to produce cherries than you could get for them. And so I think we're planting better trees. I think we're getting better yields now than we were, say, 20 years ago. But our acreage is way down. It's probably no more than a third of what it was 30 years ago. But, as I say, the trees that we have are better than they were.
And what about apples? Is Wisconsin?
Well, the apple acreage is down somewhat over the state, too, but there are a lot of new acreage. There are many new acreages being planted now. The shift is from great big trees that were grown on rootstocks produced from seedlings to planting trees now on what are called size controlling rootstocks, so that you get a very small tree. Mm-hmm. And you can put more trees to the acre. They come into production sooner. You don't have to climb up a ladder to pick them.
Yeah.
All this sort of thing.
They don't produce smaller fruit, do they?
No, they don't.
I've been very puzzled by the fact that for the past 2 years the Jonathan apples seem to all be much smaller than they used to be.
Yeah. Well, we don't produce many Jonathan in this state because it's a late maturing apple. Mm. And we don't have a very long growing season in Wisconsin.
Were there, did you have much to do with other people in, well, in other departments? Were there people who influenced you, helped you?
Well, back in the beginning, when we were very actively looking for how the virus is spread in the field, we had joint projects with the entomologists. But that never led to any positive conclusions. We never found an insect vector. I would guess that probably the closest cooperation that we've had with the entomologists through the years, we had a project at one time, what ran for about 10 years, studying the effects of fungicides on fruit quality, so that whatever we were spraying to control insects and disease, we were looking at the effects on yield, on fruit color, fruit size, sugars, soluble solids, acids, all these sorts of things. And that was a very active project
and
with the entomologists.
You were doing that too.
Yeah, I was the leader of the project.
You were.
Uh-huh. And we did that in cooperation with Professor Weckel in food science department.
Oh, I see. So he tested the quality of the fruit then.
Well, we were doing it jointly because a lot of things like quality, like color and that sort of thing, we were doing.
Yes.
He was doing the acid studies, the sugar studies. We were actually canning cherries. Huh. And that was in cooperation with the American Can Company because we wanted to find out whether the fungicide that was being used had any effect on the keeping quality of cherries. And so the American Can Company would make up special batches of cans for me that were all alike so that there wouldn't be a can variability. Mm-hmm. And we had a little canning factory of our own on the experiment station at Sturgeon Bay.
Oh, really?
Sure. And that was a very interesting project. A number of Weckel's students, I would guess 4 or 5 of Weckel's graduate students, did their PhD work on this joint project.
Well, talk some more about it.
Well, it was quite interesting because we found out, for example, that some of the new chemicals that were coming on the market were having a harmful effect on color. The color, and of course, if you think about it, what is it that sells a red cherry? It's color. And so if you were getting a reduction in color, this became very important. Mm-hmm. We found out that all the new chemicals, all of them, were reducing the sugar content compared with the old Bordeaux mixture that had been used for years and years and years. Huh. But the Bordeaux sprayed cherries were anywhere from 10 to 15% smaller in size than the cherries that were being sprayed with some new chemicals. So it was a balancing act, you see here, to try to find something that was giving color almost as good as the Bordeaux, but bigger fruit.
But what about flavor?
Flavor, some of them we had to pretty much throw out because the sugar content and the acid content, which is really what makes up flavor, were reduced with some of these so-called softer fungicides. Mm-hmm. So it had a bearing on what we were recommending. And then we learned that one of the materials that was on the market was reducing can life in the processed can by about 20%. So we had a choice. We could either throw it out or we could try to find out a better can. So American Can came up with a new liner to put in a can that got the can life back up again to where it had been before.
And was this somebody's PhD thesis?
No, I don't think so. No, they weren't involved in that. Nobody did a thesis on that.
Because there must have been a lot of other variables, such as the temperature that year and the sun.
Well, this is true, but remember now, these would be trees all sprayed on the same day with different chemicals. And then you'd go in at harvest time, take samples, bring them in, treat them like you would in a canning factory, wash them the 2 hours or so, pit them, put them into the can, process the cans, put them in storage.
This is up at Sturgeon Bay. This is on the experimental farm.
Well, in the beginning, we did all of the work except the processing in the, at the experiment station. And then we'd make a deal with some commercial grower that we could get in there at 6 o'clock in the morning before anybody else started, take our stuff down there and run it through the processing line and process it. But eventually we made our own equipment so that we could do it on the experiment station. So it was kind of an interesting project. And the interesting thing out of it all was the fact that the only differences, the significant differences that we found, were significant differences among fungicides. We never found significant differences among insecticides with respect to cherry quality. And we did this for about 10 years.
Do you know why?
No, we don't know why, other than that there would be a, an effect on the, you know, on the physiology of the tree that would be reflected over in sugar, acid, whatever.
Pesticides always bring images of, I mean, Silent Spring.
Yeah.
How much were you affected by that concern for the environment?
Oh, I don't think we were as concerned about the environment as we were about quality. Because we saw no evidence of the effect. I remember Professor Hickey in wildlife ecology came to me one day when DDT was still being recommended. And he was complaining, this was about the time that Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. He was concerned about the effect on robins, and she had quoted him, you may remember, that this story of spraying elm trees with DDT, the leaves were falling to the ground, the earthworms were picking up the DDT, the robins were eating the earthworms, and the robins were dying. Well, I showed Joe pictures where I actually had robins make nests in my cherry trees that were being sprayed with DDT. The eggs hatched, the little robins came out, the little robins grew up and flew away.
So you didn't think that was a problem?
No, I don't to this day.
You don't?
No.
Would you feel also about PCBs?
No, I don't know anything about those. But remember now, I lived in Nigeria for several years. Mm-hmm. I served on the Agricultural Technical Committee of the country. I was asked to vote on whether DDT should be used in Nigeria to control various things on human beings. About half of us were expatriates. The other half were Nigerians. We voted secretly. We voted unanimously to continue the use of DDT. And I still think it was the right decision.
And that was, what, back in 1977?
No, I was there, I lived there from 68 to 70.
So that was then?
It was in that period of time.
Have there been any effects? I mean, presumably they've gone on using it. You know, that would be a good...
Not that I know of, and of course it's still the best control, as far as I know, for lice and that sort of thing on people. And many countries are still using it.
Oh, I see, for that, but not on crops.
It's still being used on crops.
In Nigeria.
Yeah, but there weren't many crops that it was useful on at that time. No, this was to whether it should be used on people.
Yes. Yes, I can see that.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be spread around to worms.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Back when the Research and Marketing Act was passed in 1946, I think it was, this set up four regions within the United States for cooperative research. Wisconsin is in the north central region. There were in the beginning, of course, 12 states in each region to make up the 48 contiguous states. And it turned out that all four regions proposed regional projects on stone fruit virus diseases.
So that was the most serious thing.
Well, they thought so at the time. Now, that doesn't mean that all states grow stone fruits, but there were enough people convinced that that should be done. Well, it came to the point where at the national meetings of the American Phytopathological Society, the people from these four regions would get together to talk about what was going on in the region. And we actually formed at one time what was called an interregional correlating committee to correlate the research of the four regions. And when Congress, in its wisdom, decided that there ought to be an interregional research project supported with federal money, we proposed an interregional program. IR1 was a project that's still in existence. It involves potatoes. And a lot of the work that's being done here, both at the Sturgeon Bay Station and with Bob Hanneman in the Horticulture Department. Bob is the leader for IR1. And the main headquarters for the research is at Sturgeon Bay. The interregional project on stone fruits is IR2. It's still in existence.
This is the one in Washington?
In Prosser, Washington, and Moxie, Washington. Mm-hmm. And so that then brought the people together even more closely because, people had the opportunity to propose material for the repository. People were asked to provide expertise on how do you determine that the material that's going into the repository is virus-free. Each region has a technical representative on the committee. That committee meets at least once a year. Mm-hmm. And so that the policy, the overall program, is run on a national basis.
And you've been on the committee?
Yeah, I was on the committee from the beginning until I retired, except for the 2 years I was in Nigeria.
And was it very effective?
Oh, very effective, because we are getting material, requests for material from all over the world. And we are providing virus-free material for the whole world out of this project.
So it's not just research, it's actually...
The fellow in charge of the project may do research, primarily research on developing new indexing procedures as new viruses are discovered. The project is expanded now to include palm fruits as well as stone fruits. So that means there are apples and pears and quinces in the project as well as all the stone fruits like peaches, cherries, and that sort of thing. And it's a very active program. And it's supported on a national basis. It's supported out of hatch money that comes off the top. The interregional programs get their money first before the regions, before the state and the regions get theirs. So it's a very effective thing. Well, then, has been greenhouse energy.
Yes, I saw something about that. That would be interesting. Talk about that.
Well, it's a project that Professor Champ Tanner in Soils and I have been working on through the years for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I guess. Probably the most heat loss of any building on campus is through a greenhouse. Mm-hmm. And people were quite interested in how to save energy. And of course, having grown up in a greenhouse, why, I was interested. And so this project was supported in part by the energy people uptown in the State Department. Tanner got interested in the project with me because he's probably as well informed as anybody on campus as to how to use a data logger to record all types of data. And he had been using equipment of this sort in relation to his soil studies. So that we took four little greenhouses again out at the Wallen Street greenhouses and treated them differently to find out how much energy we could save. And this bubble insulating material that you see books come packed in and this sort of thing, sticking that on the glass, we could save about 50% of the fuel that it takes to heat a greenhouse.
Goodness.
As a matter of fact, I use it on part of my house. I use it on some of the windows where we don't normally look out.
Is it expensive?
No, it's very cheap. And it works very well. We started out with air cap, three different sizes of bubbles, and then determined that probably the one that worked the best was the intermediate size bubble, which is about an inch in diameter and about a quarter of an inch. Then we got over into other materials that people were using.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of a fun study, but it's not going on any longer. We learned that we could put 2 inches of styrofoam on the outside of a concrete wall around a greenhouse and go various depths into the ground and really save heat, because the 4-inch concrete wall is probably no better insulation than a pane of glass. And since the heat in a greenhouse, at least in our greenhouses, hangs on the wall, the heat just went right out through the wall. It is. And it's been real.
Yeah. This is tape two.
It's been real, real interesting to see this use on basement walls and that sort of thing. And I would say that overall, the way we did this study, we wanted not only to find out how much heat we could save, but we wanted to find out the heat distribution within a greenhouse. Because it's been known for a long time that if you have greenhouse benches that go right up near the wall, the plants that are out near the wall just don't grow like the plants that are in farther. Mm-hmm. And by putting this stuff on the wall, plants are uniform all over the bench. And we tried to find out. We were quite concerned because we know that we thought that heat distribution within the greenhouse was affected by the fact that greenhouse glass, of course, overlaps. And so there's quite an air exchange at that level, and we were curious to know what the mix would be. So we had thermocouples at all distances, all the way up to the top and back to the data logger, you know. We had light. We studied the effect of these different insulating materials on greenhouse light. How much light were you getting from outside? And we had equipment to monitor steam, so we knew how much steam was being used in each greenhouse, and all that recorded back on the data logger. And on the basis of this, we found out that for the money, the best thing was to use this air cap. This bubble insulation.
Along with the styrofoam.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cement.
Mm-hmm. The material that you see, if you go out to Johansson's, you see this inflated poly cover. It's polyethylene film that's double layered, and you blow air in between it to inflate it. That works, it's quite effective, but it reduces the light very much more than the air cap does. And we used other material, an acrylic, a cell type of acrylic material, and that works quite well, but it's very, very expensive. And I don't think that anyone would very likely retrofit present greenhouses with that because of the expense involved. So we tried a number of things, and it was kind of fun.
Did you publish it?
No, it's not been published, but it was on the basis of that the Pure Facilities Management uptown set up certain requirements for greenhouse construction for the state.
But you haven't spread the word around beyond this concept.
Well, we've talked at meetings.
have.
Yeah. And of course, I guess the main reason we didn't go to the trouble of publishing is that Ohio State has probably done more work than anybody, and Penn State, on this type of thing. And while I think that the data that we collected is probably somewhat more sophisticated than theirs, it really wasn't showing anything greatly different from what they were doing.
Why did you do it if they were doing it?
Well, they weren't at the time.
Oh, I see. You mean you started it?
No, we all started about the same time, I guess.
See.
Yeah. But they just published because, well, the data that we're collecting, of course, goes on to a data logger. Then it's put over on a computer. Then it has to be taken off the computer. And Tanner has been quite busy with a lot of other things, so a lot of our data never got put over in usable form, so that what we were reporting on was merely stuff that I would take off manually every day. And I guess 3 years' work has never been taken off the tapes yet.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, it is. So whether it'll be published or not, I'm not sure. Sure.
Is there anything else that you should talk about that would be of interest in connection with the research you've done?
Oh, I don't know. The experience in Nigeria was interesting. We there, they have a rather interesting educational system. Students at the bachelor's level are required to do what we would call thesis, do a research study. And so at the time I was there, I had students working on black pod, on cocoa, on diseases of tomatoes, diseases of peppers, and you name it, a lot of things. And that is published in sort of a form in an annual report of the research at the University of Ife. But it was fun to work with these kids at this stage and see how capable they were and how well they attacked the problem and how well they did. It was kind of fun.
It must have been.
Yeah.
And presumably their work has had some effect, has it? I mean, did they come up with anything new?
I don't think that we came up with anything new, but it was merely, how shall I say it? Well, it was giving them experience.
Oh, sure, yes.
So that as they went from college to do whatever job they would take, they were better equipped. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of anything that I would say was absolutely new. We were interested in one project, for example, that there were tomatoes that were stunted, that the leaves would turn sort of purple. And everybody was blaming a virus for this. And at the time that I went over there, we had very inadequate greenhouses. And so one of the things that we did, we built about $50,000 worth of the kind of greenhouses that we have here, and began working so that we could get away from insects, because insects are a real problem on the crops there. And we were quite interested. We could reproduce Professor Corey in soils, and I were there at the same time, and we got the idea that we ought to look at nutrition as well as possible virus infection. So we set up a whole series of pots with complete nutrient, minus this, minus that, minus whatever. And we learned that we could get all of the symptoms except the purpling with a minus manganese. And we were about to junk the plants because we felt we had gone as far as we could go. And so one day we got the idea, well, let's take them out of the greenhouse, put them outside. When you put them outside in the sun, the purple developed. It just didn't develop in the greenhouse. So it was...
So it was just manganese, if you put...
Yeah, manganese deficiency. But it was kind of fun to, you know, to do this sort of thing. This was an experiment that Corey designed, and it worked out quite well. But I guess you can say that I've just enjoyed dabbling in all kinds of things through the years, and it's been fun. When you're a florist, you learn to do all kinds of things.
Do you have your own garden?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'd like to have my own greenhouse, but my wife says if I had a greenhouse, we would never be able to travel. I'd have to stay home, take care of my greenhouse.
Surely there must be ways of putting out automatic water.
Not really. No, not really. No, I agree with her that it would be impossible to do some of the other things we want to do.
But you still work, have access to greenhouses on campus?
I haven't done anything in, well, last year we finished, I guess, finished in quotes, the energy study. Mm-hmm. There's been a rather interesting disease on wild chokecherry in the state that I have worked with. We always said it was a virus disease. We're now quite certain it's incited by a mycoplasma. And I've always been intrigued by it. And I've always said that I might want to do further work with it, but I never have. It's quite an interesting thing because it has many ramifications. The disease, as it was described first in Connecticut, was called X disease, X the unknown on peaches. And it subsequently was found on sweet cherries in California and peaches in California, up into cherries in British Columbia and all over the place. But there are differences. And it would be kind of fun to try to unscramble what the differences are.
And are there enough choke cherries in the state?
Oh, they're all over the place. If you drive around in July and you see these wild bushes turning red in July, this is X disease. And this kills the trees in about 2 years. So that they're all over the place and their trees dying. The arboretum's full of them, although a lot of them are dead now in the arboretum.
How would you go about working on it?
Well, I'd be interested to take closer looks. We've never been able to transmit this causal agent mechanically to anything. We've been able to use a parasitic plant daughter, which grows, has no chlorophyll. It grows on plants as a vine. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to grow it on an infected plant and then train it across to other plants like, we've gone to parsley, we've gone to carrots, we've gone to jimson weed, we've gone to periwinkle, things of this sort. One of my students did this. But nobody's ever been able to come back from the herbaceous plant back to a tree. It'd be kind of fun to see if you could work that one out.
You'd have to do that in the greenhouse.
I would think so. So you'd be away from a lot of, you know, problems.
And would you have access to one? Would you be able to get space?
Oh, I think so. Right now, there aren't too many people doing practical things in a greenhouse. There's a lot of unused space. How come?
Yeah.
Well, I better not put it on the record, but I can tell you why I think.
Well, that's surely must be a fix.
Well, it's because nowadays, most people are very reluctant to do research on long-time projects that take a long time to publish because of the pressure to publish or perish. And it's partly that, it's partly because there's a great tendency or trend to want to do biochemical things. And you can work in the laboratory under very controlled conditions. You can turn out research in a hurry. You can publish papers. And if you work on something like I did, where it took years to get results, I'm not sure whether you should say they're not willing or they're not able to do it because of the pressure to get things in referee journals.
Is the sort of thing you were doing, could that be done by a biochemist?
Well, not the kind of thing I was doing, no. Although, of course, people with biochemical training have gotten involved in looking at the viruses and this sort of thing.
But how it spread?
No, that couldn't be done biochemically as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. Maybe I just don't know.
When did you first notice this trend?
Oh, it's been going on for quite some time. And as those of us are retiring, we're not being replaced by people who are doing applied research anymore, for the most part. We're being replaced by other people. When I went over to farms, before I went to farms, there were three of us working on fruit. One on small fruit. I was working on tree fruits. One was half-time in extension on fruit. And one was working part-time on the viruses of fruit, but on other viruses as well. All four of us are retired. There's a new fruit man coming either in February or May, and we don't have any idea at this point what he's going to be working on.
When you hired him?
Well, remember now that in this institution we don't tell people what to do. We know he's going to be working on fruit.
But don't you ask them what they're likely to be doing?
Well, I wasn't here when this fellow was interviewed. But I suspect that we'll have, well, he's supposed to be part-time extension, part-time teaching, and part-time research.
That's a difficult combination.
And it's a difficult combination. So that whatever research he does will probably have to be done, unless he has a lot of help, technical help, will have to be done at a time that he can be here to take care of it.
And he can't be if he's doing extension.
That's right. That's right.
And you feel that some important work will go undone because of this?
Unless there's enough pressure. Unless there's enough pressure,
put on the pressure.
By the farmers. By the farmers. If they feel they're not being serviced, they can be very vocal.
Do they write letters to the department or?
Either that, or they might contact the dean. I can remember in the past when they actually contacted the governor.
What, in connection with what?
Well, yeah, there was a time that we had an active field research program both out at Gay's Mills and up in Door County. And at the end of World War II, there was nobody at Gay's Mills. And it so happened that the people came in to see the dean, and the dean explained, this was when Baldwin was dean, and Dean Baldwin explained that there was a shortage of funds and that various and sundry things couldn't be done for various and sundry reasons. And as the group got up to leave, I remember very distinctly, they said, well, thank you, Dean Baldwin, but please remember we came to you first. And he said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, we're going to see Governor Rannenbaum." It happened that the spokesman for the group was Rannenbaum's brother-in-law. So they found a way to put somebody at Gay's Mills that year. This is the kind of pressure that can be brought to bear.
Can you foresee anything happening to crops in Wisconsin that might lead to the farmers being concerned about there not being research?
Yeah, I think so, because you see what you're up against all the time. At the present time, many of the chemicals are now suspect, that are being used both as insecticides and fungicides. Mm-hmm. Some that have been in use for a period of time, we now hear are going to be taken off the market because they may be carcinogenic. Well, new chemicals are being worked on all the time by chemical companies. Probably not as many as there used to be, because now it costs upwards of $1 million of testing before you can even think about putting one on the market. Maybe quite a bit more than that. But unless somebody is field testing these materials and know what they'll do in Wisconsin, how do you recommend them? How do you recommend them?
And the farmers know that should be the function of the university.
Well, they rely on the university more than they would rely on a chemical company that's developing the material. So they would like to think that if the university has tested it and shows that it's effective, or compares its effectiveness with something they know about, they're probably not as reluctant to go to something else.
And there's still this kind of trust in the research done in the university.
Oh yes, very definitely, very definitely.
Comes out through bulletins.
Well, and meetings. Mm-hmm. You meet, there are a number of meetings each year. Not just in fruit, but I mean vegetables, forestry,
yeah,
ornamental crops, whatever, with appropriate groups of people. And they like to know the latest research and what the possibilities are. And it's also true that some of the problems are getting resistant to some of the chemicals that have been used, and so they want to know what the possible substitutions are. And if they no longer can turn to the university to find out what they can spray on cherries and apples, they might just get a little concerned.
And what do people in the department say about this?
Well, obviously, some of the powers that be in the department have thought otherwise. But they've put priorities in other areas.
As I understand it, was it plant pathology, or maybe it was horticulture, that got a number of people who left the genetics department?
Well, they had a few people that went to genetic engineering. One of them went with...
Bob Hogus is an example.
Well, Bob Hogus, of course, is retired.
Yes, but he was originally in genetics, and then when the split occurred, he moved over, isn't it?
Well, I'd rather Bob told you what happened there.
Well, he did. I'd
but,
forgotten him.
Yeah, well,
I know that
he felt that the type of work he was doing, that he'd have more support in horticulture than he would in genetics. Yeah.
And just the point is that the horticulture and plant pathology were still the applied.
That's right, that we were still.
Ceasing.
Well, I'm not saying it's ceasing, but I'm saying that it's being downgraded. Mm. Being downgraded. Yeah, Hogus and I worked very closely together. We developed the greenhouses at Sturgeon Bay. He was the first leader of IR1 that I was talking about.
Oh, I see. Yes, he has talked about it.
No, Bob and I have been good friends through the years. Yeah. Well, I'm sure it'll swing back. We've seen this before. Mm-hmm. And these things go back and forth.
Is it easier to do the biochemical research than to do the field work, would you say?
I don't know that it's easier. I think
well, let's that... Let's not say less... you don't have to...
Depending upon what the project is.
Yeah.
Depending upon what the project is. It's much easier if you can just stay in your laboratory.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Than if you have to go someplace else to do it. And a lot of what you're doing, depending upon what you're doing, you can get results more quickly. Publishable results mm-hmm. more quickly. So it's an interesting development, and I'm sure it'll swing back ultimately.
Well, there's more status in it, too, besides the present.
Yes. Well, this is true, because, finding a referee journal to publish, many of the referee journals for basic research alone mm-hmm. are more prestigious.
Yeah.
I think that's right. So we'll hope. No, I don't want to shortchange this fellow that's coming. I've never had a chance to talk with him. It's my understanding that I think they interviewed 4 or 5 people for this present position. And as far as I know, there wasn't a single one of them who was interested in viruses, virus diseases of fruit.
So they're not covered at this point?
Well, they're not covered in the state. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so sure about what anything that can be done so far as the industry is concerned. I'm not sure anything further needs to be done. But I liked it because what I was doing was both practical and basic. It gave me an opportunity to do some basic research as well. And I think there are things that can be done which may not have a direct benefit to the fruit growers of the state. There are many things that could be done from a basic point of view. See, there's another virus disease in the state which we didn't talk about. It's called, green ring yellows. And we found an index host for that, which was kind of interesting. And Fulton has tried to transmit that one mechanically and was never able to do it. So I think that would be fun to work with that one. And also to find further hosts, further diagnostic hosts.
Is that of wild plants or cultivars?
No, this is on sour cherry. It doesn't reduce yield significantly. It just makes a whole tree full of yellow leaves with green rings in the leaves along about late July. And it is transmissible, and it would be an interesting one to work with.
So that would be just, as you say, kind of detectable without
yeah.
any necessary...
Not necessarily any direct, other than it might help if you could come up with a different index host, it would benefit the repository out in Washington because it would help, it could give them a diagnostic host that you could rely on more quickly than the one that's now being used. Hopefully. So you never know what the outcome will be when you're doing something like this. It might be quite significant in relation to that program.
And how long would you expect such a project to take if you wanted to?
Have no idea. Fulton has tried for about 5 years to transmit it mechanically without any success. but he hasn't looked for other plant hosts than herbaceous plants. So, I would suspect that the fun things would be, if possible, to try to work with people in some of these developing countries where food supplies is short.
Have you been to countries other than Nigeria?
Well, I've been in Indonesia.
For scientific reasons? Or?
Yeah, the university has a project which is just ending at Institut Pertanian Bogor.
Oh.
And
I've passed that many times.
It's a project that's been going on. Well, I think the current project is due to end in August. It's been going on for 4 or 5 years. And a number of short-term people have been there. My responsibility there has been to work with them in relation to their experimental farm program, because the project, there was a project originally that was concerned with undergraduate education. This current project is concerned with graduate education. And we've been looking at it in terms of developing experimental farms in the training of graduate students. So it's been kind of fun.
How often do you go out there?
I've only been there one time.
For how long?
I was there 6 weeks, about 6 weeks for one time. And then the people have come here. I have met with them here twice, I guess. But it's quite different from Nigeria.
Yes. Rather pleasanter to be in Indonesia, I should imagine.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. Although I wouldn't characterize it that way. There's a the big thing now is what's called farming systems research, and it really isn't anything greatly different from what was done before. I think it's primarily a different name for funding. It's what it is. It's a system of trying out the crops, ways of growing crops, ways of growing livestock, integrating livestock and crop programs on small farms, and then having gotten some information, taking them out to small farms to try them out.
Now, are you talking about here in this country or
no.
Third world countries?
Third world countries. There's quite a lot of so-called farming systems research going on. And the meeting we had here last year when the people came from Indonesia was to put together a project on farming systems research for funding. And that may start next year. We don't know yet. It may be funded next year.
By what, AID? Or
yeah, USAID.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was something you helped work out?
Yeah. There's another project starting right now in the Gambia. I probably will not be part of that one, but people will be leaving next month from here. It's again a project. Most of our programs in the past, in international ag programs, have been with universities. This one in the Gambia is with the Federal Ministry of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And it's to go over there and help them set up programs for increasing food production and also working on export crops for the Gambia.
And this is a mixture of representatives of different departments, is that right?
Yeah, the design team that's going over will be Professor Pope in meat and animal science, Professor Ream in agronomy, and Ken Shapiro, who is the new Associate Director for International Ag Programs. And they'll be joined by an economist from Michigan, not Michigan State, but Michigan, and a rural sociologist from Virginia State University, who is black. And they're going to design a project for the Gambia. And then there'll be other people who will be recruited to go on long-term basis. And so I'm not sure how that's all going to work out at the present time.
Is this something that even though you're retired, you might?
No, I wouldn't go long-term. But if they need help, there are two experimental farms in the Gambia. And if the design team feels that I can be of any value, going over at the time that the permanent people go next summer, then I might go for a month or two. Mm-hmm. But that would be it. No, I don't have any desire for a long-term commitment any place at this point in time. Well, I guess I can't think of anything else to tell you at this point.
I'm glad we had those pauses because you kept coming up with something else that was interesting. All right, well, thank you.
Well, you're most welcome.
What I wanted.